Disclaimer. The views and opinions you hear expressed by the participants in the show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show! Hey everybody, welcome to Ancast. I'm Zach Birchie. Justin's here.
Hey everyone.
And hey, we're doing a first segment.
What?
I know. Crazy. Has the world gone topsy-turvy?
When was the last time? It might have been like a year since we've done one of these.
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, usually we fit this kind of chatter into like a Twitter show or something. Right. But it's been like about a month since we taped. We had a show like 2 or 3 weeks ago, but then the holidays happened, and then spring preview. I just always refer to it as spring preview. I think it's just because those words go together in my brain. But winter preview prevented us from doing an episode last week. And so I wanted to go over the last month because plenty of stuff happened and watched plenty of stuff and lots to talk about. So let's, I guess just out of the gate, I did want to talk about Otakon Vegas.
Oh, yeah. How was that? I sat that out because I just wanted to be at home really badly after the holidays.
Yeah, which, you know, if I had been smart, the con itself, the convention itself was perfectly fine. It was a nice small show, and it was a small show. This entire convention took place basically in a hallway, maybe two hallways. It was, you know, lightly attended, couple thousand people tops.
The first year show.
On the mezzanine of the Planet Hollywood Hotel and Casino on the Strip.
See, that's the other reason I stayed home. I cannot stand Vegas.
Well, we'll get into that. But the convention itself was fine. It was small. The panels were sparsely attended, but they had good panels. They had some okay guests. They did the premiere of Space Dandy, which, of course, got kind of ruined by the fact that the show leaked hours before.
Right.
Which, you know, just goes, actually 2 days before, which just goes to show you can't have a premiere at an anime convention that where the room hasn't already seen it. Like, this has been happening forever. It is like the curse of anime convention premieres. Because I remember fucking 2001 going to Anime Expo. They had the world premiere of the Oh My Goddess movie, which the day before was bootlegged and on the internet because someone had like ripped a telescene. Like, you just can't have it. Like, you can't have the nice thing.
The nerds can't help themselves.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they know what's right, but the new content, I guess, you know, morals fly in the face of nerd enthusiasm sometimes,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah. Going to that premiere was fun, and it was fun watching that show with a big crowd that, you know, really ate it up. The sumo wrestling was neat. I was in the room before Mike Toole got in the ring with the guy. we left before that happened, but
I really wish I was there to see that, and yet I'm kind of glad I wasn't there to see that.
Oh, it was just silly fun. Like, the whole thing was like an exhibition, like a Harlem Globetrotters kind of a thing. Like,
right.
They had like the world champion who isn't in professional sumo. Like, he's the world champion of sumo in this global circuit, not inside the Japanese circuit.
I see.
You know, the one that matters, I guess. But, but you know, these were big dudes. I've never seen live sumo, so it was neat to see it, for sure. Everybody at the convention was really friendly, not a lot of annoying teenage histrionics. The dealer's room was tiny. Like, really small. Three aisles, that's it. Smaller than a panel room, in fact.
Wow.
Yeah, super small. Funimation was trying to do a thing. They had a bunch of Space Dandy stuff, but yeah, it was a real small show, smaller than Anime Los Angeles, I would say.
Anime Los Angeles has gotten so mopped the last couple of years. They didn't invite me as a guest speaker this year, so I'm like, stay home.
Yeah, I would have gone, but then I realized, wait, I spent last week at an anime convention, and Hope got super con crud. Like, she was still sick a week later from, and I always assume it's just from touching anything in Las Vegas.
Well, any anime convention, even under the best circumstances, every railing has a layer of slime on it.
Well, okay, right. A heavy crust of bacteria, yeah.
Right.
But, you know, now you're in Las Vegas where, you know, that banister you're touching was power had all the semen and vomit power hosed off of it less than 3 hours ago. So, you know, you're going to get some germs.
3 hours is all it takes for it to build right back up.
I really hate Las Vegas. I can't
stand it. It's the worst place in America.
It's so horrible. I understand why they're holding the convention there. They must have gotten it for a song. Like, it was a small convention space in a sort of mid-range hotel. The rooms were, like, nice but really, really cheap. You know, I think we were paying, like, $80 a night or something like that for a pretty decent hotel room.
Right.
I had a lovely view of the air conditioning system on top of the hotel.
So hot.
Oh, God. But the place itself wears on you so fast. You know, you go downstairs just to get breakfast. To do anything, you got to walk through the casino, which smells like an ashtray. And right. It's bing, 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 bong, 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 bing, 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 bong, bong, bong. You know, the casino slot machine noises just nonstop. You cannot eat. Two people cannot eat for less than $40. You can try, but you're going to be eating real garbage if you're eating beneath that price level.
Mm-hmm.
Like, everything in Las Vegas is just gouge city. And
it's
the place
insanely overpriced.
It's insanely overpriced, and for what you get. Like, you know, the crappy Cirque du Soleil shows are $100 a seat.
Yep.
When those shows travel, they're $45 for good seats.
Hey, there's a reason Britney Spears is holed up permanently in Las Vegas now.
Well, yeah, and speaking of Britney Spears, so, like, her residency is in Planet Hollywood. So oh. I saw nothing but her face for 3 days. So, we walked up and down the strip, and it was miserable, and eventually the freezing wind started, because that happens there, and, ugh. Like, I believe Erica Friedman described it as piss elegance. So it's like the trappings of elegance for people, I guess, who don't really know what that is. And Everyone, when you're walking around, no one looks like they're having a good time.
Unless
everyone looks really sad.
Everyone's just like this really unhealthy looking, miserable person who clearly just lost a lot of money.
Yeah, they're a shuffling husk, unless they're drunk, and then they just look like a drunk, sad person. I fucking hate Las Vegas, but they're having it there again next year. And again, the convention itself, if you want to go to a nice small show, and next year it'll probably be closer to mid-size. I recommend it. And they moved it away from the holiday, so it's not so close. I think next year it's mid-January, which is still fine. But further away from the holidays and after a pay period for most people is a better time to have that show.
Yeah.
Do that convention after someone gets a paycheck.
People are broke after Christmas.
No shit. I was broke going into that convention. Thank God I did it for work, so it was all per diem stuff. But, man, you don't want... Las Vegas is the last place in the world you want to be where you're watching your wallet. Like,
no.
You don't want to be like, oh, man, I got to sweat this, $80 meal. If you got to sweat an $80 meal, you don't want to go to Las Vegas. go when you're flush with cash. Or don't go at all, which is really my attitude towards the place.
It's my two favorite things in Vegas, which are both ironic.
Uh-huh.
And I think they're both in Caesar's Palace. The first is the Caesar's Palace awful, terrifying, cobwebby animatronics.
Ah, yes. Atlantis, yeah.
God, those things are the stuff of nightmares because there's nothing behind the cutout eyes. Mm-mm. So they're just black voids that you stare into while they pivot lifelessly. The other one is, I think it's in the mall area of Caesar's Palace, and it's, those awful Charles Kincaid painting shops where, it's all a bunch of theatrics to make you feel like you're buying a piece of art that's not been a mass-produced piece of schlock.
Mm-hmm.
They had that for photography. And it was all this one photographer, I think. But it was just like these really lame, pointless, not particularly noteworthy stock photo images of, like, nature and shit.
Mm-hmm.
Except with the color saturation cranked up to 11. and like priced at $5,000 each.
Yeah. Those fine art shops are like, last time I went to Vegas was like maybe 3 years ago, and there are more fine, quote unquote, fine art shops now than there were then. And we walked past one that was like the bronzes of, you know, some artist you never heard of, and these bronze pieces were they were embossed, so it was like, you know, the size of like a stand up mirror. Embossed bronze of like the back of a woman wearing a sheet, but her ass is exposed, and it's just basically you're buying a big bronze butt. Like, it's the most tasteless thing. It is belongs in like a 1980s Coke dealer palace. Like, that is the only place you would find something like that. Just the ugliest, tackiest shit everywhere.
And you know, people must be buying this stuff if it's still there, which is just the most depressing thought on the planet.
Well, I think rent is nothing. Like, rent has to be kind of nothing in order for those stores to stay open, because you never see anyone in them. There's never anyone in there. But, you know, even though I was there 3 years ago, I went back and saw stores that by all rights should have been closed, because I've never seen anyone in them. But they're still open. So rent must be either really cheap, or they're subsidized by something, or owned by the guy that owns the mall or something like that.
Well, I'm sure, you know, the markup on a $12,000 bust of all dog versions of The Last Supper, that markup has to be upwards of 98%.
Right, so they got to sell one thing every 2 months.
Yeah, they're like, we made rent!
Yeah.
And payroll!
Yeah, right. Yeah, the place is just, it's fucking miserable. And the annoying thing about it is, like, well, there's only four things to do there. There's only four things to do there, and they all cost a shit ton of money. So it's not, like, affordable anything, or it's not even, like, because I don't mind spending money on something where I feel like I'm getting my money's worth.
Sure.
But that rarely happens there.
No,
most of the time you're just paying too much for something that in L.A. would cost half as much and be twice as good. So, like, but we were on, like, the tram, taking the tram back because the winds were freezing. And it's like, on the next stop, shopping, gaming, nightlife, dining. I'm like, that's all there is to do at any of these places. That's it. Shopping, mm-hmm. Gaming, nightlife, dining. That's it.
Well, if you drive 10 minutes, there's also the epic shooting ranges.
Shooting, yeah. I don't like shooting guns, so it's not for me.
Well, okay, maybe not guns, but what about a grenade launcher?
Yeah, I don't derive any pleasure from that stuff, but okay. Everyone talks about that, though, now. Like, that now, like, I'm going to shoot a grenade launcher is the new I'm going to collect all the porn cards. Like, now it's a cliche. Everyone says it. Like, it's just...
Just because everyone says it doesn't make it not fun?
Maybe you're right. But then you walk around and you see, like, the sidewalks are covered with those porn cards, and you see all the people with their kids, and kids walk with their heads down staring at the sidewalk. You're like, oh. So awful. Again, convention's fine. Fuck Las Vegas, man. Fuck it.
Yeah, I no.
I made a joke to Hope. I'm like, we're going to come back next weekend for the deluxe vacation package. She was like, nah!
Every time a friend of mine tells me that they went, I think a little bit less of them. I honestly do.
It is for a very particular kind of Broheim pretending to be a high roller culture.
It really is. And honestly, no one gives a shit.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, who are you trying to impress here?
Well, that's right, and the whole culture there changed to appeal to that specific type of guy who's like, I'm a big shot, I made it rain at this club, I paid, you know, $89 for bottle service per bottle of, you know, $28 Grey Goose or whatever. You know, like, I spent way too much fucking money to let people know that I can afford it. And it seems like that entire life, that culture that they're propagating, that culture that they're appealing to, is specifically targeted at people who probably really can't afford it.
For the most part, yeah. I mean, there are people that can.
Right. It's like fantasy. It's like fantasy millionaire camp.
Right.
Except they actually take all your money.
I'm friends with exactly one person like that who is actually a decent person, and I still haven't figured out why. And, like, I will probably never get to the bottom of it.
Anyway, enough ragging on Vegas. The convention was good. I did enjoy my time at the show. It was nice, low-key, laid-back, perfectly competently run, not a lot of problems with panel scheduling or anything like that. Did enjoy the show, didn't enjoy the city, but whatever, we've been over that. But so, other than that, before we get into the winter season here, let's talk a little bit about movies, because, you know, Oscar nominations were announced this morning.
Yeah, it's actually a very good list, and anime actually got represented twice.
Yeah, not a lot of surprises, but yeah, pretty good list, I think, overall.
Yeah, I'm really hoping that Her will take home something. I don't think it will take home Best Picture, but...
Nope. Yeah, screenplay, I think.
It's too relevant. It's too relevant and is clearly going to be historically important. And, you know, Oscar doesn't like important things. They like to be told what they already know.
Yeah, so, like, at this point I've seen just about everything. I'm a few behind, but I've seen most of the stuff that's been nominated.
I haven't seen Philomena.
That's the one I haven't seen. I still haven't seen Dallas Buyers Club, but that'll be remedied here pretty quick.
I've had enough friends see that I think I can sit that one out.
Okay.
Yeah, it sounds like not all that compelling.
Mostly it's just people talking about the performances in it, and when that's all I ever hear about it is the performances are great, usually mm-hmm. that means the story's probably not that great, so, you know, or not that compelling. So, yeah. You know, typically that's what that means.
I did go see August Osage County last night, expecting it to take home a lot more nominations than it did.
Mm-hmm.
Holy shit, was that an awful movie.
Yeah, you really hated it.
I hated that passionately. I almost walked out.
Wow, yeah, that's... you described it as, like, you know, obnoxious, over-the-top actor movie.
Oh, yeah, it totally is. It's totally, like, everyone gets a chance to be dramatic. I lost count after, like, the third plate was thrown dramatically. And it's just, it's so over the top. It's super, super, super soap opera-y. You can tell where it's going every second. And it's just, it's so self-indulgent. I had no patience for it. None.
Well, it picked up almost no nominations.
I was pleasantly surprised by that, given how, you know, the Academy is largely geriatric actors. So
Right. Maybe
even they couldn't deal with it. That'd be a thing. It was a Weinstein, so you know that, you know, I'm sure it was micro-targeted to that audience. And the fact that they didn't fall for it makes me happy.
Yeah, I can't remember who made the suggestion, but somebody said something to the effect of, imagine how different the nominees list would look and how different the winners would be if in order to vote, you have to have a credit less than 10 years old.
That'd be pretty cool.
Like... That it seems like I would imagine they can't make that kind of a rule change, but it would. I feel like doing something that drastic would make them a lot more relevant.
Yeah,
you'd see a lot less like really, really mediocre stuff getting nominated. Yeah, so I've seen a lot of stuff, and far and away the best thing I saw was Her. Like,
oh yeah.
By a gigantic chasm, like,
without question,
the difference between that and the second best movie I saw in 2013 is huge. Like, I thought Her was total genius. I thought it was just great.
It was not only is it the smartest sci-fi I've probably seen in a decade. I think it'll be one of those movies that we keep referencing back to in the zeitgeist. You know, like Gattaca.
Yeah, right. It's just It's just distant enough in the future where it's a totally realistic version of what it seems like life might be like maybe 5 years from now. To me, that's not the most interesting thing about it. Like, it's also like the most deeply empathetic, raw, emotional movie that I've seen in a really long time. Like, that whole movie is just about emotion. I was taken with how empathetic it was, and it really digs in deep to some really core emotions. Like, I was talking to some other friends about it, and they were talking about how one of them saw it with a girl he was in the middle of a breakup with.
Oh my God.
I know. And I was like, you gotta be kidding me. You didn't walk out? That must have been the hardest experience.
Either that or it might have helped.
It may be. I don't know. It could have. I would never want to watch that with a girl I was breaking up with. Holy shit.
Yeah,
But yeah, no, absolutely fantastic movie. If anyone's on the fence about it, stop. Just go see it. Like, it's so good.
even if you're kind of adult about these sort of things, you should go for the video game parodies.
Yeah, that was pretty good too. But yeah, no, really, really liked that. What else did I see? I didn't like American Hustle at all. I know you liked it. I didn't like it.
I thought it was okay. Like, it was one of those things that I enjoyed it in the moment, and then the more I thought about it afterwards, I'm like, oh, that was really facile and not all that deep.
Well, somebody, actually, I think it was Red Letter Media, pointed out that it's just David O. Russell just letting his actors do whatever the fuck they want, and you're not, when you don't care about the characters, and the movie doesn't even seem like it's all that interested in the story it's telling. It's more interested in the camera focusing on these actors doing these wacky performances. I don't care about any of that. I want a story, and I want real characters. I don't want fucking Christian Bale doing his Robert De Niro impression, and then I'm supposed to fawn over that. Or, you know, totally miscast Jennifer Lawrence. Like, I don't know why people are praising that so much. It's just, a lot of those people seem kind of miscast. They're all wearing goofy cartoon character 70s clothes. Right. And at no point during the film did I give a shit about the story at all. Like, I just didn't care. The
story was really hard to follow and not all that compelling once you did finally get what was going on. I was nodding off during the first half of it, probably.
Yeah.
But, you know, once things got going, I actually did enjoy Jennifer Lawrence's character for just, like, the silly cartoon that it was.
Right.
I don't know. Like, I found it mildly entertaining. I don't think I wasted my time watching it.
Well, it's right now it's a 50-50 shot between that and 12 Years a Slave to win Best Picture.
Which I haven't seen, and honestly, this is kind of a shitty thing to say, but I feel like everything that could be said that's interesting about slavery has probably been said at this point, and it's like the Holocaust. It's one of the worst things and the most black and white awful things in human history, and I feel like there's not a whole lot of room for nuanced storytelling in there because it's just that awful.
Nuanced storytelling? Why would you want that in a movie about slavery? Okay, you're wrong on several reasons, on several counts okay. There. One, there's like maybe 10 movies about slavery that are not just about the brave white people that put a stop to it or whatever. You know, even stuff like, you know, Amistad is chiefly about the white guys who did a thing about this.
Amistad was all speeches. That movie's a piece of shit.
Yeah, but, you know, Django Unchained is fantasy revenge a la Inglourious Bastards.
Right.
And it's a great movie. I love Django Unchained, but it's fantasy revenge, and it's kind of funny and stuff. 12 Years a Slave is completely unflinching, totally, it's engrossing, it's unpleasant to watch. It's the movie, honestly, it's a movie about slavery that we don't have yet, that hasn't existed yet.
Oh.
It doesn't pull any punches at all. To pretend that, like, American film has covered our own biggest sin, our own greatest atrocity, in the same level of damning detail that Holocaust movies has, is profoundly untrue. Django Unchained opened such a wound. Like, you remember the reaction to that movie. People were like, oh, like, you know, acting like it was offensive that the movie was so, like, fuck these people. Fuck the people that propagated this. Like, they deserve to die a horrible, bloody death.
Right.
That was controversial.
I don't remember that part being controversial.
It was. It was considered controversial. People were like, this movie's kind of unfair. You're not really thinking about what? Like, you got to be kidding me. Like, yes, it's a totally black and white issue to people.
Was that
like,
really a mainstream opinion?
It was certainly made.
I could see that being on Reddit.
It was certainly made to be by the media at the time, which really chomped onto that.
Right.
They were like, oh, can you believe this reaction to this movie? You know. That kind of thing. But, I mean, I think you should see it. I really do think you should watch it.
Okay.
I think once you see it, you'll understand, oh, movies like this about slavery really don't exist.
Okay. Like, that's fair. Yeah. I mean, I'm just very reluctant to see movies that are that, what's the word? deal with something that heavy, because usually there's no fair way to portray stuff that awful without being just marinating in awful.
Sure. At the same time, like, at some point you have to kind of let go of the notion that, like, you're surely, okay, well, let me just clarify here. You're not saying that you're afraid this movie isn't being fair to slave owners.
Oh, fuck no. Why would why would that even be on my radar?
Well, you're like, well, I don't know if it's not going to be nuanced enough. It's like, there's not a lot of
nuance. I don't require nuance in, like, you know, the issue. I require nuance in the characters and the portrayal of individual pieces of events, because that's how real life is.
Yeah, I guess. Well, and there's a lot of that, but it, this whole movie is focused on the main character, and there's nuance in his reaction to things and why he does the things that he does and the actions that he's forced to take and why he takes them. Like, there's nuance there.
Right.
There is no and there's nuance in the Benedict Cumberbatch character and stuff like that. But I think you should see it. I think you're prejudging it a little too harshly and thinking that maybe it's something that it's not. And yeah, there's a lot of talk of, like, comparing this to, like, Holocaust movies. America has not, cinematically has not dealt with slavery in the same way as cinema has dealt with the Holocaust at all. Like, at all. It's still a relatively recent thing, and it is a wholly American sin, like the worst chapter in our national history. That there's a part of the country that still doesn't want to acknowledge it.
a good third of it, in fact.
You know, so that's the reality. I don't think you can really compare it. But anyway, enough about that. This is supposed to be an anime podcast.
I feel like there was one other movie that I saw that... Oh, yeah, Inside Llewyn Davis.
Still haven't seen it, and I don't know why.
I love the music. It's superbly made. I love the actors. I love the cast. Holy shit, is it depressing.
Yeah.
It is utterly... Like, there's a couple little moments of quirky Coen Brothers weirdness, but there is no joy to be had, and it is unrelenting.
It's not, like, funny depressing like a lot of Coen Brothers movies?
Some people are saying that it's funny. I found no humor in it.
Really?
I just, maybe I could identify with the plight of a guy who's kind of a, you know, who's just trying to be the best artist he can and maintain a, you know, maintain his personal integrity and just falling on his face. Maybe that's just something I've been too close to with the people I've known in my life, but I found nothing humorous about this. It is just sad and relentless and awful, and basically, I mean, you remember A Serious Man.
Yeah,
the Coen Brothers keep making these movies where it's just a nice guy who can't catch a break.
Well, I thought A Serious Man was funny, though.
It was funny. This is not. Take all the humor out of it and make it set in winter with bleak colors and cold, and take all the humor out of it, and you have this. With great music. Great music.
Well, I'll check it out.
Still. We're seeing, but I needed to, like, break up a Prozac and do a line of it afterwards.
Yeah, I don't know. It's fun catching up with all this stuff, just because, you know, it felt like most of 2013 I spent just watching junk. And now I'm packing in all the good stuff right at the end. And,
yeah, that's what always happens, though.
Yeah, for sure. So the winter anime season started.
Yep.
And apparently you haven't watched anything?
I am in serious burnout recovery mode.
Okay. Well, right, hey, understandable.
Yes.
I watched a bunch of stuff, as per usual, for the preview guide. And happy to say that the changes to the preview guide were very well received. And so we'll be doing it that way from now on.
Awesome.
So it'll be divided by series and not by author. People really like that. And no matter the fact that it's a tremendous amount of extra work for me, that's fine. You know, it's worth it. People really liked it. So
Dance Monkey.
What's that?
I said Dance Monkey.
Yeah. So look forward to that moving forward.
So not worth repeating.
But so watching Space Dandy, and we have it on the DVR, and I watch it on Saturday nights. Yeah, it's kind of what I expected it to be, which is Uncle Watanabe's playhouse. It's totally just screwing around. There's hints at more, and I imagine there will be sad episodes and darker episodes and serious episodes and all that stuff. But mostly just seems like he's just letting his writers and directors just do whatever the hell they want. He talked it up that way. He basically said, like, yeah, we're just gonna, you know, I want the animators to have a showcase. I want them to, you know, let their imaginations run wild, and I also want to make something really stupid. So here you go. I don't know why people thought it was going to be Cowboy Bebop, but it sure isn't. I do like it. I thought the second episode was a little weak, but hey, Dice Otto wrote it, so there you go. I took a little shit for like saying like, oh, Dice Otto wrote this. No wonder it's not that great. But I think his best days are behind him. Like, his early career is great. His stuff now, especially his writing, I just haven't been that impressed by. I thought all of his stuff on Fujikomine was super weak.
Mm.
But yeah, so I guess we're gonna get some Sayo Matamoto stuff and stuff like that. So as in a sort of like a playhouse for his stable of directors and writers, it's a really fun show to watch, and I look forward to seeing it every week because I know it's gonna be different. I know there will be something else, you know, some other visual idea or something like that in there. So I do really like it. I don't understand why the expectations for it were so weird. It was never going to be Cowboy Bebop, so I don't know why people are let down that it's not.
Well, because the way it was being positioned, it was, and you know, the way more or less they actually marketed this title, as opposed to most anime here that just gets flushed through the usual chain of distribution.
Yeah,
you know, when something is paid that much actual attention to on the marketing level, people expect it to be the second coming now, because that never happens.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
It is a layer of mega hype that anime just doesn't see anymore.
Yeah, and you know, even then, like, we call it mega hype, and it got about as much actual hype and attention as, you know, something like a movie that would get dumped in February or January. Like, I was still shocked to see they did run ads for it on ESPN, which I saw a couple of them, which was neat. That was neat. And I do think it's got the potential to pull in a little bit of a broader audience, because it's weird and it's colorful and it is funny and it's fun to watch. And, you know, I think if anything, this does have a chance at maybe pulling in some new viewers, but and the ratings for it are solid. So, you know, good for it, I guess. I don't know. Just because it's hyped up doesn't mean it's going to be Cowboy Bebop. You know, like, just manage your expectations, people. Like, he said in multiple interviews, one that we ran, that this show is going to be just stupid fun. Like,
right. I mean, I wasn't expecting any, you know, any heaviness, really, from this. Yeah.
I will say the meta humor in it really sucks. Yeah. It's not good. I wish they would stop. I don't like it when there's a narrator and the characters refer to the narrator. It's not funny. Like, that's just never funny.
No, that joke was old when Bugs Bunny did it.
Yeah. Yeah. Other than that, I didn't really see anything else that caught my attention. Everything seems to be, the general consensus seems to be, it's a lot of mediocrity this time around, but it's winter, so I guess that's normal. But yeah, not a lot, not that much else to really write home about.
Yeah, I mean, I was looking at the list because, you know, I still have to do the internal reports that aren't for public things, and there were a couple that looked interesting to me. Like, well, I'm a big Yasuo Miyamatsu fan, so I had my eye on Wizard Barristers.
Oh yeah,
which looks fun, unimportant but fun.
Really nice animation.
Yeah. It seemed like a lot of good, but very little great this season.
Yeah, which, you know, a lot of the quote unquote great stuff does get saved for spring and fall, and those are the two big ones. And, you know, winter and summer are kind of the throwaway places, which, you know, after years and years and years of doing these preview guides, it's pretty obvious what the patterns are. I'm a little surprised Space Dandy launched now. You'd think that would be more of like a spring thing, but
yeah, who knows? I mean, these things percolate so much; it's hard to even tell. I mean, these things are in pre-production for so long; it's hard to tell if there's actually an intent to get them to premiere at a certain season, yeah, or if that's just how they land.
When it's ready, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, to that end, I was, you know, as part of that report that I do, I also look forward to the next season. So I was looking at the spring shows. Mm-hmm. And just as I'm finishing, this new Masaaki Iwasa adaptation of Ping Pong gets announced.
Oh, right.
And I am peeing my pants in anticipation on this thing.
Big fan of the Ping Pong Club, huh?
Yeah, it's exactly Ping Pong Club. No, it's not Ping Pong Club. It's actually, you remember the movie that came out about 10 years ago?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I know you know that, but I'm saying that for our audience's sake.
Right.
It's actually one of my favorite movies. I really, really love that movie. And the 30 seconds promotional spot that came out really shows that they were very, very heavily influenced by that movie for the anime version.
Oh, okay.
So, not only that, because it's Iwasa, he'll be able to stick a lot closer to Taiyo Matsumoto's very weird kind of garish artwork, which I personally love. And I don't think he's ever been given a really good faithful treatment. I still fucking hate Tekken Kinkreet.
Yeah, well... For those of us that remember Tech on King Kree, we don't really remember it all that fondly.
Oh, it's a piece of garbage. But anyway, I'm excited to see what promises to be the first good adaptation of Taiyo Matsumoto's stuff. Even if it's something I've mostly seen before, it's a good something I've seen before. And let's see. There's a couple that I was surprised. Did you know that they're rebooting Sergeant Frog?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, I was never a huge Sergeant Frog fan, but I wonder if that means that they're going to try again with the U.S. market on that.
I can't imagine that. It was never a success here.
No, it really... I don't know why they would, but that seems like something that they would try.
Right. Oh, God, that would be such a mistake.
Wouldn't it? Although, you know, one of the big problems with older shows now is that they're not resaleable if they're 4x3 these days. Like 4x3, even digipaint shows, just look too old and there's very little you can do with them. They've lost a lot of their value. Hmm. So you really need, for a show to be relevant at all, you need it to be, if not in HD, at least widescreen. Widescreen can be upscaled and a lot of people won't know the difference.
Right.
But, I have my eye on that one, and this one called Fun Ishin Dai Shogun, which, your favorite, Dai Sato.
Mm-hmm.
But also produced by the Cat Shit One guy.
Okay.
But it looks like kind of classic late 90s Meiji era with mecha, you know, emphasis on the core young male teenage demographic. Lots of action, lots of sword play, some fan service. It looks like it could be a lot of fun, and the artwork looks like Kawamoto character designs, if I'm not mistaken. I don't know if he actually did it.
Wow, that sounds interesting.
Yeah, my eyes on that one.
Okay, all right. All right, well, I think that actually wraps us up for this segment. We should probably just go ahead and get to the interview. And we're back. Guest this week, very happy to have this guy on. Been meaning to have him on for a little while. It's Charles Dunbar. He's if you've been to an anime convention recently, more than likely maybe you've seen his name in the guest list or on the panel schedule. Most recently he did approximately 8,000 panels at Otakon Vegas. He's a lecturer, a scholar, and you can find him at studyofanime.com. Charles, thanks for coming on the show.
I appreciate the invite. I've been wanting to come on here for a while, too.
Well, cool. Well, we're glad to have you. So I want to sort of get this out of the way. Could you just sort of describe what it is you do and how you got started doing what you do for our audience?
Oh, this is just one of those things that only happens in anime fandom. God, was it now? 5 years ago, I was doing all of my my research for my master's, and I was going to a lot of cons doing surveys and asking people to comment on con culture, because that's what I wanted to write on. And I met a lot of really interesting people. Towards the end of the year, I just asked a convention if I could do a panel on mythology and anime, and the con said yes. And I went, great panel, great reaction, great crowd. I got bit by the panel bug, and that was 5 years ago. And now this is my job, going to conventions and going to libraries and speaking at different events just on Japanese culture, anime, anime fandom, really whatever they want to hear and whatever I feel I can do justice to. So it's interesting.
So you make a full-time living doing anime panels?
I make money off doing anime panels. I do a lot of different things, but the lecturing, the library lectures and the Suffolk cons is the bulk of my income right now.
Well, there you go. Kids, your dreams can come true.
I would never advocate doing what I do. I wouldn't. I'll be the first to admit it. It's hard. It's physically demanding. It's emotionally demanding. It's mentally demanding. And the only reason I do it is because I'm insane.
Okay. So what sparked your interest? I mean, obviously this is an academic pursuit, sort of chiefly. So I would imagine the desire to do this sprang out of your years at university or...
The story of how I decided to do the fandom thing literally is one of those ideas that only happens when you're in a car coming home from a con and completely out of it. I actually trained as an archaeologist.
Oh, okay.
And I did. I spent years doing archaeology. And I'm coming home from NekoCon 2008. And I recently discovered that I don't like archaeology. Okay. After 8 years, I discover I hate archaeology.
Well.
Yeah. So this
why,
is this
the
is,
fact
this,
that nothing actually happens when things are just dead in the earth for years.
The problem is I went to a school that taught archaeology as kind of ancient history and culture trade, which I find fascinating. But when it came to the actual digging, I sort of hated it. They never told me that I had to dig.
That's
which is
kind of a big thing.
It's a major fail on my part. You can be an archaeologist without actually digging, but I unfortunately learned too late that digging is not something I enjoy. So I'm coming back home from NekoCon in 2008, and I'm ranting about how the last 8 years of my life have gone to some friends that I trust, and one of them mentioned offhand that if I like cons so much, maybe I should study cons for my master's, and I discovered I couldn't give her a reason as to why I couldn't, and then started the whirlwind 2-year process of doing the field research that culminated in my graduation in 2011. And by then I was already doing a bunch of conventions and I was already doing a bunch of like side lectures to pay my bills. And the moment word got out that I'd graduated, more cons started contacting me because now I had more free time. And 2012, 2013, I did how many cons in the last 2 years? I did something like 40 cons or 35 cons in the last 2 years.
That's
yeah.
A lot of cons.
Yeah, I've already done 2 this year, and it's, what, the third week of the year?
Can you imagine the antibodies you've built up?
I don't get con plague anymore at all. I mean, if I get con plague, it's weird. I got con plague after Comic-Con, New York Comic-Con. Do not know how.
It was wet, I think.
Maybe.
Yeah, you're like, well, I stepped in this puddle of toxic fluid. Managed to get con plague that way, but that's about it.
All of my friends got Otakon plague. I didn't. I came home, I slept for 2 days, and went to the next con.
Oh, jeez. So that schedule, like, Justin, you could probably comment on this. Is that more rigorous than your average voice actor?
Depends on the voice actor. during a busy summer, like, the bigger con whores will pretty much do that, but...
Do you want me to edit out con whores?
Well, I'm not calling Charles a con whore, but, you know, there are lots of con whores.
I'm a total con whore. I can't...
Okay.
I can't get enough of them sometimes.
Then I guess I will call Charles a con whore.
I am a con whore, yes. I'm okay with that.
But that said, wow, that's... I couldn't imagine... That sounds exhausting.
It is. I joke about my age, because when I started doing this, I was still in my 20s, and I could do 3-4 panels at a con, shout to the back of the room, get really energetic, and I'm fine. Now I do 2 panels in a day, and I'm like, oh, I gotta go to the hot tub. Where's my Epsom salt? I joke about the toll it takes on my voice and the toll it takes on my nose and on my back. Last year at KatsuCon, I actually collapsed. In the middle of a panel, I stopped for 30 seconds, fell on a table, and then recovered because it was just too much.
So your body's telling you stop, and you're like,
my body's telling me stop.
They're like, no, I must talk about the anime.
I like money. And this is a great way for me to teach, pay off some of my loans, go to cons and, you know, just have a good time. Because when I'm not like lecturing like crazy, I have wonderful times at conventions. It's just when I do some cons I go to, they schedule me 4 or 5 panels over the course of a day, which I used to be able to do that. I can't do that anymore. When I get 4 or 5 panels in a day without long periods in between to rest, I start to feel it. Like after the 2nd or 3rd panel, my voice gets hoarse. My back starts to hurt. My stomach starts to get really tight and I have to like really caffeinate and force myself through. But I do it anyway, because I'm not going to stop. I mean, you're going to come into that room. You want to see me present. I will be there. I will present for you and I will give it to you. And when the day is over and I have no more panels, then I will sleep for 12 hours.
I mean, it's fun, but it's exhausting being up there talking.
It is. It's very exhausting.
Yeah, especially when you put actual effort into it. Not like Justin and I when we show up and say, ask us questions and we'll give you garbage prizes.
I mean,
hey, it takes some work to track down those prizes.
This is true.
I practice the fire hose method. I don't know if you've seen me present, but with me, someone at Otakon last year said that listening to me talk was like standing in front of a fire hose. So I stand there and I just blah everything out at once. And I that's like, it gets people interested, it gets people excited, and it gets people to keep coming back. But at the same time, I talk very, very fast and very, very loud, and half the time I don't use microphones. So it's a matter of time before my body goes to hell.
Yeah, or your throat gives out, one of the two. So let's talk about some of your pet subjects, because I've noticed that looking over your typical sort of panel schedule, it's 7 or 8 different topics that you tend to focus on, and a lot of it is Japanese culture as it relates to anime and manga. So what's your favorite panel to give, and tell us a little bit about some of these subjects and how you try and like what's your overall theme and message?
Well, my overall goal, my overall message has always been the same. I want to just, when I find discover something new and I get excited about it, I want other people to get excited about it. And I want to show other people that these aren't, it's not just Japanese cartoons, which I think anyone who watches anime has figured out. But sometimes I get really into the whole, this is, when you understand Japanese culture, or you understand certain nuances of Japanese culture, the shows get all the more interesting. Like, I've been working on something related to Kill la Kill of late, and Kill la Kill is a fantastic show. But right before I watched it, I was reading a book on a certain like Japanese legend, cultural legend, and all I'm seeing while I'm watching Kill la Kill is this legend playing out before my eyes. So I've been writing this down, and I'm trying to find a place to put it out that isn't my website. So things like that, when you notice the subtle nuances, it leads to a deeper appreciation of the show. It leads you to start noticing in other shows you may like certain themes that you may not have noticed before. I do that a lot with my Ghibli presentations. I have a lot of fun watching Ghibli movies and pointing to how the Ghibli films can be traced to specific moments in Miyazaki and Takahata's lives. And when you watch them all in a row, you get the picture of a guy who had a breakdown, a crisis of faith, then re-explored his past, then decided to have fun with it at the end. So a lot of the time, that's what I do. That's what I get really involved in. Plus, I also noticed that a lot of people are really interested in Japanese culture, but they don't know where to start researching.
Right.
So give them a place to start. These are my observations. Here are the books I read. Go for it. Have fun. Go forth and prosper.
It's refreshing to hear you talk about Kill la Kill.
Love that show.
Just because in my experience talking to people who are interested in anime from a academic perspective, it seems like, and maybe this is an unfair stereotype, but this is based on firsthand experience, they only ever talk about Ghibli. And references seem to be from the late 90s. They talk about Evangelion, Ghibli, and maybe one or two other things like from the late 90s. Basically, gigantic phenomenons from 10 years ago. And then that's it. And frankly, an academic study an academic lecture that does not mention Studio Ghibli, that sounds really refreshing to me. Like, that's more what I want to see as somebody who's been obviously observing this stuff for 15-something years. Like, I want to see more of that. I don't know, like, obviously you observe the academic culture surrounding anime, I'm sure. Maybe you've noticed that.
I do. Oh, I mean, I've noticed, like, the Critical Darling series. Like, Ghibli gets pointed to a lot because of international exposure, because the Ghibli films really are fascinating. And if you want to, like say what you will about certain writers, I loved some of Susan Napier's work on the female stereotype and the female deconstruction in Ghibli. I loved what she did with that.
Yeah.
I love when I read about Ghibli films and like what people write about them. Some of them are it's like really astute. Ghibli's easy to see. Ghibli is recognizable.
Right.
But then like a show will come along like Kill la Kill that on the surface looks like boobs in school uniforms. And there, someone sees something there, and it really is just the first 10 minutes of that show when I first watched it, the whole introduction to the school. I leaned back in my chair, picked up my phone, texted my friend, and said, "Are you watching Kill la Kill?" "Yes." "State Shinto?" "Yeah, totally." And that's just something that you get when you get like people sitting around and talking about it. And there's a lot out there. So I thoroughly enjoy when people give attention to the smaller shows and attention to the things that may not be as wide-reaching, because the smaller shows, they're being created for a specific audience, and that audience will either get the joke or it won't, but when they get the joke, it's really satisfying.
Right, right, right. So you're sort of engaging people about Japanese culture through this stuff, which is, you know, that's a pretty common thing for people to introduce people to Japanese culture through anime. But what do you find what kind of feedback do you get from your audience? What kind of panel attendance do you typically see? Like, we were both at Otakon Vegas, and just as virtue of that being a smaller show and the first year of that show, panel attendance was pretty low from what I saw.
It was a little low. I mean, some of the panels, like the sumo, got good attendance. The anime openings, they typically get really good attendance. I had about my smallest attendance crowd was I did a yokai panel on Sunday morning, and I think I had 25. That was my smallest.
Okay.
My largest was the panel this past year that's been getting really good reviews that shocks the hell out of me is the one where I talk about convergence theory and con culture, which was what I did my master's on.
Right.
I am continually impressed at when that panel gets scheduled, and it gets scheduled at all hours of the day. I mean, I've had it at 11 a.m. at Otakon. I had it at 11:15 at night at Otakon Vegas. I always get a really good turnout for that. When I gave it at Otakon, it was 11:15 Friday morning. I was expecting 50 people. I had 1,000. When I gave it at Otakon Vegas, it was 11:15 at night. I expected 10 people, and I had about 60. So that one had a great turnout, and this I get the same responses when I give the panels, and it usually comes into people coming up and saying, you know, I never thought about that before. Wow, that makes so much sense. Or you've really inspired me to look deeper into the shows. What I'm not really trying to introduce Japanese culture to people. I'm trying to point out Japanese culture, how it's interpreted in anime, because anime is a really interesting way of interpreting Japanese culture, and it leads to it makes it more accessible to the fan. So my goal is here's what I'm seeing. This is something that you should take a look at. And then the people do. And then they go out and they look at the books. And then I get emails from people saying, you told me to read Fandom Unbound and I loved it. And I can see all this stuff now, to which my response is great. More people should read that book. More people should get a deeper understanding of the medium, because once you start to really understand it, now you can really talk about it and have a great time discussing it with people. I mean, that's how it started with my anime club and my friends in college. We would just watch a show. One of my friends would say, oh, look at all this Greco-Roman stuff in Utena. Really? There's Greco-Roman stuff in Utena? And that sparked a 3-hour conversation.
Okay. All right. Well, that's cool. So that's typically your experience engaging with your audience.
The audience wants to be there. And that's one thing I've always seen. People have told me this. The audience wants something more. Like, the people that go to panels want something more from the convention than just line up a bunch of cosplayers and do a Q&A or show random videos and scream. They want something more. And I started noticing that the more panelists do this, the better attendance the panel crowds get. The more people come to the con and they want to give back to the community, the more they want to just appreciate anime for what it is. And that's really rewarding when you can go into a panel, get a bunch of people really interested, and then the next year you come back and like they're giving panels or they're talking about their favorite stuff. That feels really good, knowing that you pointed something out to someone and now they're really getting a lot of fulfillment from it.
Yeah, that's cool. Mm-hmm. That's cool. So before we start talking about the heavy convention stuff, so you were an archaeologist or in archaeology for 8 years, decided you hated it, went to this. Before all of that, how did you get into anime?
Dragon Ball Z.
Okay.
Card game, no less. Okay. I didn't know what Dragon Ball was.
Score.
The card shop where I used to play Magic the Gathering, they got in the Dragon Ball Z anime hem card game back in like 97 or 98. And everyone in the store played it. So I started playing it, and I'm looking at these character cards. I'm saying, this looks like an interesting show. So the rule book came with a synopsis for the series. And I read the synopsis. I immediately went to one of my friends, and I live in a neighborhood that's predominantly Asian. It's been predominantly Asian since the early 90s. So getting access to this stuff turned out to be very easy. And I said, I want to know more about Dragon Ball Z. So my friend said, well, it airs at 6:30 in the morning on one of the local networks, and I'll see what I can find. I wake up at 6:30 that Monday morning to watch this show, knowing nothing about the show. And I'm looking at the show and I'm saying, this is the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen in my life. And yet I cannot look away. And then he gives me some tapes, and I get involved in that. I get involved in Sailor Moon. I never had cable, so Toonami was just not a thing for me. And then, like, they start the VHS tapes come out, and I start watching Gundam Wing, I start watching Rurouni Kenshin, all courtesy of friends who would just throw stuff at me. And I started going to the local science fiction convention, and they had little anime things there that I would go to. And that all started tail end of the 90s, about 15 years ago. I started getting involved in the medium, and it would go through periods of snowballing where I get really, really into it, and then I would like step back. Then I get really, really into it, and then I'd step back. And then 2007, 2008, I started going to cons again. I started reading manga, and that's been the kick since about 2007, 2008. I've just been crazy into it since.
All right. Well, Dragon Ball Z, you know, that's a gateway drug for millions of people, I think.
Pre-Pokemon, pre-Toonami years.
Sure, right, exactly. So I really want to talk about this convention stuff because I'm fascinated by it, and I really want to hear sort of the Cliff's Notes version of your convergence theory. I've never had the pleasure of attending one of those panels, and I really want to hear about this because personally, I mean, I'm sure Justin might be more on my end of things too, where we go to conventions for work, and they all blur together. It's a total blur experience for me at this point. I enjoy going, but they all, like, for me, chiefly, it is a very repetitive experience at this point. So I want to hear about this convergence theory.
Well, I'll see if I can give it to you in the simple. You know what I should do is I should open up the panel. I have the panel on my computer. I should just open it up. But the general idea is I'm a big fan of Henry Jenkins. I love Henry Jenkins' work, and I read a lot of Henry Jenkins' work. And one of the things when I was reading his book Convergence Culture is he makes a point of talking about the convergence in media, the idea of content flow across multiple platforms, cooperation between industries, and the migratory behavior of media audiences who will go anywhere in search of the entertainment experience they want. I boiled it down to fans dictate their fandom experience. If what they want doesn't exist, they will create it, and the interaction drives growth and community. So when you look at the way conventions are now, when I started going to cons, there was the science fiction con and the anime con. And you went to the anime con for the anime, and you went to the science fiction con for the science fiction. And then I stopped going to cons for a few years, and I went back. And I started to notice, wow, there's a lot of Jedi walking around this anime con. There's a lot of Wolverines walking around this anime con. Mm-hmm. And I started to notice that in the last 5 years or so, the conventions have become sort of a one-stop shop for the pan-geek or the multi-fandom pursuit. People go to cons because it's a good place to connect with other fans. They go to cons because it's a good way to discover new fan practices or new series. But rather than being solely focused on anime, now the fans are coming to the convention as a way of meeting other like-minded people, gaining entrance to an open community, and dictating what they want out of that community without fear of repercussion or backlash from older generations. I remember the sci-fi cons being ridiculously closed. I remember trying to get involved in science fiction communities in the 90s and being told that I wasn't old enough, I wasn't well-read enough, and they did their best to close the community to newcomers who didn't go through their vetting process. And a lot of anime cons just don't do that. They're ridiculously open. Anything goes. If you want to do something at a con and it doesn't exist, make it yourself. And you decide how you want to experience the weekend. A lot of conventions don't shy away from doing that. And a lot of fans go to the conventions now as a method of meeting people and furthering their fandom, as opposed to furthering the object of their fandom. I once asked Daryl about this, and he made a wonderful comment where he said, anime fans today are often fans of anime second, and they're fans of something else first. And when you go to the convention, now they're using anime as a way to interact with other fans and then discovering what those other fans also enjoy. And then you get like Whovians and Bronies and Homestucks and Hitalias and Jedi and Marvel Comics characters. And they're all coming and converging on this one event because they can go. They know they're not going to be criticized for being there. They know they're going to find like-minded fans. They know they're going to meet new friends. They know they're going to geek out for a weekend. And then they can go home satisfied. And that was the general crux of what I was experiencing and what I was writing about. How now the anime convention has become the motive in and of itself. You go to the con. You don't go to the con for another reason. You go to the con. I think I called it fandom for fandom's sake. You're being a fan because you like being a fan.
So you're suggesting that it's being a fan now is a lifestyle rather than just sort of single-minded devotion to a television show or a comic book.
That's what I'm seeing. I mean, you look at shows like, you look at how the mainstream portrays it, and look at shows like King of the Nerds, where they're portraying this as being fan lifestyle, and it glorifies this idea that if you're a fan, you belong to something, and if you're a fan, you can make new friends, or you can be cool, or you can get something out of being a fan that you can't get elsewhere, despite the fact that everyone is a fan of something. What they're doing is they're like, it's like Orientalism making the East Asian cultures look really exotic like 150 years ago. You're starting to see that with geek culture, or you are seeing that with geek culture now, that the geek culture is being viewed as something exotic and different and awesome, and why wouldn't you want to be a part of it? So I'm seeing a lot of conventions doing that. I'm seeing a lot of people going to conventions who may have come into the fandom in a different way than I have, who've come to the convention from an internet culture point of view, where they're used to things like Tumblr and Twitter and spreading this stuff around really quickly and really at the drop of a hat. So they're finding their gratification. It's a lot easier to get happy and excited about something. So they go to the con and they find other people that practice fandom the exact same way they do. And next thing you know, instant network.
Okay. How would you respond to the attitude that what this is ultimately doing is, you know, the attitude you're talking about, convergence, you know, or fandom as lifestyle, has been, I would argue, almost completely co-opted by gigantic entertainment conglomerates. And the idea of what a geek is now is pretty much ruled by about 6 or 7 mainstream franchises, and that is basically all you see at anime conventions, is those 6 or 7 mainstream franchises. It is predictable almost to a fault. If it were this wonderful, weird, diverse fan culture, then wouldn't you see more than just the same 6 franchises promoted and repeated and talked about and cosplayed as over and over and over and over and over again?
Well, I do see that other side, but that other side is not very visible. What you're saying about the whole control by media, that is totally true. I mean, I see that. Everyone sees that. But that, like, is very big on the con floor. It's very big on the cosplay side. But one thing that I've always loved about conventions is there's the whole other side, like the fan art side or the fan community side or the small collective side, that once you notice that and notice the I guess you could call it a counterculture to a counterculture. You have con culture, and then you have the thing that runs underneath the surface. And once you start seeing that, you're starting to see something completely different. I see the mega conglomerate people, and if that's how they want to do, that's great. Then I will go and I will call up my friends and we will go sit in a room and nerd out about whatever, like Persona, or we'll go to the artist alley and talk to artists about like the obscure images that they're drawing. That other community is still very much there, and that other community will always be there. Even though the visible side may look corporate controlled, there will always be like a counterculture to that running around through the convention. You just have to open your eyes and look for it. And sometimes it hides itself extremely well.
Okay, well, all right now. Well, I mean, I go to a lot of cons. And I guess I would just like some examples of what it is you're talking about. Because even if you go, you know, walk through Artist Alley, you know, okay, so it's a slightly different take on Doctor Who. I guess I'm not familiar maybe with exactly what it is you're talking about when you mean a counterculture. Like, because ultimately, like, yes, it's fandom is lifestyle, but this is still a quote-unquote lifestyle that is entirely built on appreciation of pop culture franchises.
Oh, yeah.
So what are you talking about in terms of counterculture? Like, what are these people celebrating?
Well, okay, good example. Last year at Otakon, I was wandering through the Artist Alley, and you see the same predictable, like, 800 pictures of this, 800 pictures of that. There was one girl sitting in the Otakon Artist Alley who was doing traditional Japanese woodblock prints of traditional Japanese woodblock subjects. She was doing yokai. She was doing some underground Nintendo characters. She was doing her own original characters, and I thought what she was doing was fascinating. She had a couple of, like, Attack on Titan prints that were drawing people to the booth, and then when people would come to the booth, they would see her other stuff, like her Kitsune images or her Tengu images, and they were buying them as well. A couple of groups down from there was a girl who was doing tarot cards done with anime characters. And again, there were mainstream big things, like the big blow-ups were the major characters that people know. And then all of a sudden, like, image of Amaterasu, the sun goddess, as both her wolf form from Okami and a human version of it. Right next to that was another one for a Spirited Away character that was not, like, big and overdone, but it was clearly there. I see, like, when I go and look at the artists and look at their portfolios, every artist knows how to draw people to the booth, and they also show that this is something I'm doing to get people in. These are the images that I love doing, reconcile, and get people to browse. And you see people walk up to the booth, and you see people like, oh, look, Attack on Titan, Squee. Then you see someone walk up to the booth and say, hey, that's a really good interpretation of Tsukuyomi, the moon god. How did you come about doing that? And they have that same exchange. They talk about the Japanese folklore, the Japanese culture. The person buys the print and goes on their way. And you've got the big crowd that knows the major thing. You've got a couple, like a smaller group that knows the independent thing, all going to the one artist. And the one artist is feeding both sides simultaneously. That's what I mean by when I say there's an underground culture. It's you have the things you notice, and then you have the things that are right underneath that you might not. But when you do notice it and you do understand what they're doing, it goes to show you that these people are still celebrating other aspects of the fandom than what is being pushed by the big media properties.
Right, and there's a parallel here to what you do with your panels.
Yep. I will talk about Ghibli in my panels, and I will talk about the biggest franchises in my panels, and then I will tie it into a smaller franchise. I just gave a panel on Japan's Sphere of Technology. And once on my fatalism, I talked about Godzilla, Akira, and then Capellian.
Okay.
And there you go. People didn't know what Capellian was. I explained to them what Capellian was. Now people want to watch it. Because it's the goal of finding those ways of bringing the big stuff together with the small stuff that leads to an appreciation for all the stuff. And some people want to do it and some people don't.
Right. Okay. Okay. Well, that's an interesting take on it. I'm glad to hear that, because these days when I go to a convention, it's like Marvel Comics, DC Comics, Star Wars, Doctor Who, Star Trek, Homestuck, you know, same seven properties over and over and over again, and you'll get, you know, now it's Attack on Titan everywhere, which is fine. I don't mind seeing, like, a popular anime, because obviously I'm invested in that, and I want to see anime be the big popular thing at the anime convention. You know, maybe it's a little selfish.
Yeah.
But I tire of nerd culture, because it just seems like it's these same five or six things, and I didn't, you know, I really just didn't notice any kind of an underground thing. Like, It would appear to me that the common nerd attitude is that Doctor Who is underground, which it is totally not. or that somehow it's still a special thing that you're really into Star Wars, which it is totally not. So you get what I'm saying here? Like,
oh yeah.
Yeah.
I once made an argument at a panel that, nerd culture and like, I saw a lot of this when I used to work in music, and I used to see this with punk rock as well. This idea that even when the property goes mainstream, they still want to think of it as underground because they still derive a certain amount, a certain emotional tie to the property. And once it goes mainstream, oh, it's sold out, or oh, this happened. So they either ignore it or they try to find something about it that's still underground. Like, you can still have underground Star Wars culture within Star Wars. You just have to work to develop it. You have to work to get that kind of experience. And one of my friends is very fond of saying that the quote unquote true nerd is the one who is willing to work to get their experience, whereas the casual nerd is the one who just accepts what's handed to them.
That's interesting.
I mean, for me, for me, fandom is something I worked at, and it's something I put a lot of effort and energy into, and I spent a lot of time. Like, when I get involved in something, I get involved in something. I don't just accept what's been given to me and appreciate it and then go on my merry way. I will get involved in the fan community. I'll get involved in the discussions online. I'll get involved in the different readings of the narratives, and that's just something that I do personally. And that leads me to get personal fulfillment. Some people don't want to do that. Some people are very content to come into it, just accept what's given to them, say, I'm a fan of this. And then in a year, they move on to something else. That kind of transient nature to fandom has always been part of the fan community. You will always find transient fans. And then you will always find the lifers, the ones who put a lot more work into it. I'm not going to say that the lifers have a more satisfying experience, but what I'm going to say is both sides view what they want from fandom differently. And one side is perfectly happy to be a superficial consumer, and the other side is perfectly happy to not be. And when they overlap, you get Doctor Who going mainstream. When they underlap, you get Stephen Moffat's Doctor Who going mainstream. And I will curse Moffat till I'm blue in the face. I hate that. I hate what that man has done to Doctor Who.
Okay.
That's a story for another podcast.
Yeah, not this one.
Yeah.
Well-known non-fan of Doctor Who.
not really a big viewer myself.
Yeah. So like, your ultimate story, are you planning on continuing to do this? Like, you mentioned that, you know, it's starting to take its toll on you. What's your 2014 looking like?
I already have about 10 or 11 cons this year. I already do. I mean, this January, I have three. I have two in February. I think I have two or three in March. I have two or three in April. I have like three in June, one or two in May. I already have about two cons a month every month until July.
Right. So you're never home.
I've already said yes to all of them, and I'm going to all of them. I can't promise anything after that. I can't promise what 2015 will do. I am burned out a little bit, and no one is surprised to hear me say that I'm burned out a little bit.
Right.
But when I say I'm going to do something, I'm going to do it. And I've already agreed to do it, so my 2014 is pretty much set. I will do it. And one of my greatest jokes is I always say every year, I'm retiring. I'm stopping next year. I started joking about that in 2011. Nope. I'm still doing it 2 years later, 3 years later, so I know that I'm going to keep doing this. And as long as people still want to talk and they still want to discover more about their shows and they want to get a little bit further into their appreciation, I will always be there to answer questions or talk to them.
Excellent. All right. Well, I'm definitely going to make it a point to next time we're at the same show, check out that Convergence panel, because I want to hear the whole thing. I have
sound recordings of it if you want to hear it.
I got a lot of theories. Well, you know, I'll see it firsthand.
Okay. It was really great at Otakon when I had Daryl up there, because Daryl and I don't often see eye to eye on things, but I respect his opinions a lot, which is why I asked him to be on the panel, and that panel was amazing.
Cool. All right. Okay. Twitter ate some of the questions that we had for you, unfortunately.
Ooh.
But I've got at least one here for you from Angel X03, who asks, what are your hopes for Psycho Pass Season 2? I'm assuming this is based on you being a fan of the first season.
I was a huge fan of the first season, yes.
And she asks, or AngelX03 asks, what are your hopes for Season 2 and Akane now that she's grown, she's a grown, hardened character?
I always thought that Psycho Pass ended way too quickly. I was satisfied with the ending, but the way they set it up, I was looking at it saying, oh, there needs to be more here. We need to see how Akane has now come out of, like, the shadow of Kogami. It's like you see Kogami as a character mentoring Akane. Now Akane has taken on Kogami's role, and I want to see how she approaches it, because now we've got someone who has lived on, who lives on both sides of the law, someone who they had such high hopes for in the first series, and now how she has become the dog in the second one. I am so looking forward to seeing how her experiences have shaped her and how she reacts, because we saw how Kogami reacts to the civil system. We saw how Kogami reacts to the world and how justice ended up being his end goal. I want to see if Akane follows in his footsteps or finds a way to surpass what he did. So I'm really looking forward to seeing how she chooses to approach everything, because those little, that little grin that she gave at the end of season one, it could have meant so many things for her character. And I'm really looking forward to seeing where that goes. I think that she is going to, if you thought Kogami was crazy, I think she's going to take it to the next step, and she's going to know how to do it without upsetting the balance of the system.
Aquadraka asks, was there a fall season show that really caught your attention?
Aside from Kill la Kill? That was the one. Kill la Kill was the show of the fall. I watched that. I watched Capellian, and I watched Gingitsune. Gingitsune caught my attention because we don't see a lot of openly Shinto-themed anime. We see anime that have Shinto elements, but here was a show about a shrine priestess and her shrine herald and their shrine, and it had a lot of promise. I watched it for about 5 episodes, and then it just got a little too cutesy for my appreciation, so I stopped. But that one looked great just because we need more Shinto-themed anime. And Capellian, I got through the entire thing of Capellian. I didn't particularly like the pacing on it, but it was great in terms of, like, the exploration of the fatalism in Japan. But come on, Kill la Kill. If you're not watching Kill la Kill, you're doing it wrong. That show's amazing. Everything about it's amazing.
Okay. Yeah, apparently it's got a reputation, or Capellian does. It has a reputation of being a bit of a flop. Like, I don't think it was very popular.
Yeah, people said, like, it was beautiful, but, like, the story went nowhere.
It didn't go anywhere, and that's why I forced myself to watch the entire thing. After episode 3 or 4, I lost my motivation to watch it, but I forced myself to finish it just because I wanted to see where it was going. And in the end, a lot of promise, just not a very good delivery.
Forcing yourself to watch something, you know, like you're supposed to do with entertainment.
If you don't like it and you don't have a motivation to watch it, I mean, then why are you watching it?
Hey, I ask my readers that all the time.
I've yet to get a good answer.
I they never say it. The answer is, I still want to be part of this conversation. That's always the answer. They still want to be able to talk about it week to week. And a lot of it is hate watch. They started hating the show, and they want to talk about how much they hate it. And that's a lot of it. The internet has changed how people consume entertainment. Anyway.
It's a smorgasbord. It's all there for you to see. So sample everything.
Well, okay, maybe I should rephrase that. Like, okay, yes, that's true. The internet has changed how people interact with their entertainment and reasons why they watch. You know, that's changed. 20 years ago, you wouldn't watch something specifically so you could engage with the internet about it.
Yeah, that's what mailing lists were for.
Right, yeah, unless you were part of, you know, Rec Arts Anime or whatever. Anyway, Custom Zaku asks, what do you think of Space Dandy so far, and particularly about its mixing of Japanese and Western humor sensibilities?
I love it. I mean, after watching the premiere, Doug Wilder over at AnimeCons TV said it's like watching Futurama and Cowboy Bebop getting smushed together. And every time I watch it, I can't help but think the same thing. It is quirky and irreverent and fun. And that is the main reason I watch a lot of shows, is because they're quirky and irreverent and fun. What I love about Watanabe as a director is he knows how to meld Eastern and Western tropes so well that both sides can appreciate it, which is why I love Cowboy Bebop. And it's why I love Space Dandy. This guy knows how to make something that appeals to both sides, because he doesn't just rely on one thing or the other. He finds a way just to make them work. And if, even if the thing shouldn't work, somehow when he does something, it does. And that's what I love about Space Dandy. It just works. I mean, you're not watching the show because it's high art. You're watching the show because you can appreciate it and laugh at it.
Yeah. We got into this a little bit in the first segment, so I'll leave our comments on Space Dandy there. But, yeah, a lot to say about that show. All right. Kit Flowerstorm asks, between Japanese horror tropes in film and anime and American horror tropes, stop saying tropes, which and which trope is your favorite?
Yes, and Kit Flowerstorm is the reason I'm having trouble with Tumblr right now, because I wanted to answer her question on Tumblr. But truth be told, and this is how I always put it, Japan does really good narrative and does really good experimenting. America does really good atmosphere. So when I'm watching a Japanese horror movie, I'm expecting something like to be either completely insane like Haosu or Tetsuo the Iron Man, or ridiculously creepy in its execution like Ringu. But then when I watch the American movie, I'm paying attention to what they're doing with the lighting, the sound, and the set design, because America still can make an amazing set. And when I watch the American versions of Japanese horror movies, the one thing I always point to is the pacing, the tension, the music, and the lighting really enhance the story. So that's my thing. I mean, Japan, great for your story. America, great for putting it in a world that scares the flying bejesus out of me.
Assuming Japan can finish the story.
Haosu, but that was the 70s.
Right. Well.
Well, yeah, that's the exception to the rule, I think.
Yeah. Japan likes to sequelize. I love what they did with the Hanako movies, where they turned Hanako of the Toilet from this playful little ghost that comes out of the John to play with school children into a psychotic killing machine, and then they stretched it out to like 4 movies. That's like a really short urban legend. You didn't need 4 movies for it. But hey, I'm not telling Japan how to do their thing.
Okay, well, that actually wraps us up. Charles, great pleasure having you on the show. Really,
I much appreciate it.
Finally get to talk to you. Where can people see you next?
My next con, I will be at OhioCon next week. Then I will be at KatsuCon, Valentine's Day weekend, and I will be at Ring of Fire Con in Virginia Beach at the end of February. The rest of it, my usual how haunts, I will be at Anime Mid-Atlantic, and I will be at ConBust and at TekoshiCon, and probably ZenkaiCon. So if you check studyofanime.com, I do post my dates as I get them.
Excellent. All right. Well, everyone, seek those out, and once again, thanks for coming on the program.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, that's our show. Big thanks to Charles for stopping by. The theme song is Bucharest. It's by the band The New Division. You can check them out at newdivisionmusic.com. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes, leave us a rating or review. We'd really appreciate it, and we'll see you all next week.